going to be the what we'll follow all the way through, but a good starting point is the beginning of the Bible, the very first book, the book of Genesis. And there is a definite distinction to the first 11 chapters of the book of Genesis. They're very different from the rest of the book of Genesis and the remaining four books. These books tell the story of everything that happened before Abraham. And it is funny, most of the stories that you and I know from the Bible you find in these first 11 chapters. And they are of a very different nature than the remainder of the book of Genesis. They deal with deep questions. Questions about the creation of man. Create questions about the nature of man. Create questions about the relationship between man and woman. Questions about the existence of evil, the cause of evil, our relationship to evil. These are dealt with in these first 11 chapters, and they have a very different nature than the remainder of this book. They deal with the great realities in a sense of living today, and this is their basic purpose, to help you understand something more about the way you can live this particular day. In these, there's three major, in these first 11 chapters, there's a triple division. You go creation and the fall. And there are two stories there, and that's going to be very important. We'll look at that in a moment, separating them. And then you go the story of the flood, and then after the flood, you go from the flood itself, when it's all over, to Abraham. And as I said, there's a very different kind of a pattern. Well, we're going to go through those chapters. I'll summarize them for you pretty much in the order that they're dealt with because of how deep the truths are that are taught in these chapters. Before I do this, though, nobody was here to pass this stuff on. Everything changes, as we'll see, when God enters history, really comes into man's history and starts preparing his people in a very unique way, calling Abraham from everything he knows. Before that, God's dealings have got to be very, very different. So who was recording what was going on? It isn't the kind of records that the Jewish people keep. What they keep basically begins at Mount Sinai or Mount Horeb, two different names for where it happens, where God, through Moses, makes an agreement with people and says, listen, I'm going to be your God. If you will please allow me to be your God by being my people. This took a motley crew who basically had a blood relationship with one another, and it made them a nation, a people. Whatever God did through Moses at that mountain became their way of understanding everything else that God ever was going to do. If they kept the covenant, if they kept their terms of the agreement, they knew that God would never break his, because he took the initiative forming it. So that when things went bad, they also knew they weren't keeping the covenant at Mount Sinai. When they lost their nation, well, I'll briefly summarize this next time, and were taken into exile, the return from the exile is viewed in the pattern of all these great events that happened with Moses. And it doesn't just begin at Mount Sinai. It begins with the people enslaved in Egypt, and God slowly calling them from that slavery in a great way, freeing them, taking them to the mountain, and there touching them and making them his own. So they took this Sinai experience as the pattern of looking at the rest of their history. They also took it at going backward. Now they already knew who their ancestors were all the way to Abraham. So when they looked at their ancestors, they saw God dealing the same way with their ancestors. He formed a covenant with them. God forms a covenant with Abraham. Then when they tried to go back even before this history and answer basic questions, they would still use this pattern. Okay, so here you have people. Nothing's being written for a long, long time. Moses leads the people out of Egypt about the year 1250, most scholars, 1200 years before Jesus. For at least 250 years, there's no nation even. Nothing is written for almost 350 years. Abraham would have lived another 500 possibly before that. So the stories of Abraham are passed down for at least 500, 600, 700, maybe 800 years before they're ever written down. And they're passed down in different groups. We'll see that even after this, before they're written, the nation divides into two groups, into a north and a south. The south is very favorable to David. The north is very opposed. The north, incidentally, is conquered and becomes the 10 lost tribes. The stories, they sometimes they get along well. Sometimes they really fight wars against one another. So the stories will be carried, get slightly different colorings, whether they're passed down in the north or the south. What I'm sharing all this for is, before the book of Genesis, that we'll be looking at in a moment, is written, there are four different series of traditions that are brought together. One is called the Yahwist. It's the oldest, and it is from the south. That'd be a little bit important to know, in one small little sense. It's the first one written. It has a deep respect for this holy name of God. When Moses says, "What's your name? You want to send me to the Pharaoh? Well, what God of all the gods shall I say is sending me?" And God gives his name. Say, "Yahweh sends you." Say, "I am sends you." This tradition won't use the name Yahweh until that moment, and it uses it in a very reverential way. This is the tradition, it deals with almost all the stories of the Bible you know, you'll find out of the Yahweh account. This tradition teaches deep truths through simple little details in a story. And it makes God very manly. The big word for that is anthropomorphic. When you take God and describe him in human terms, there's such a funny one in the flood, the story of the flood. God looks at the world, he sees how sinful it is, and he's sorry he made the whole mess. The sentence is in, right in the Bible. For I am sorry that I have made them. You know, God has human regrets. It just didn't turn out the way I hoped. Wish I'd never, you know, gave it a kick and started it spinning. Now that one isn't teaching a deep truth. But it'll say that God walks in the garden in the cool of the evening. That's a way of showing that God offers fellowship to man. It'll say that Adam names the animals, and I'll share with you the deep truth taught there, that all the animals are brought to Adam to give a name. There's a very deep theological truth coming. So it teaches theology through little points in stories and makes God very, very human. Paints God in human terms. There's another one that will tell most of the same stories. You don't have to remember this one at all. It's from the north. And the only differences that'll come is in its attitude toward the name God. It prefers sort of a neutral name. It isn't his own personal name, it's his group name. And where there is a difference, it'll generally be the differences between the north and the south traditions, different campfires, different ancestors that they preferred. So sometimes this tradition will have one of their ancestors doing something. This one will have another. And you can have the same story passed down for two different people. For example, there's a story of Abraham, where Abraham, 90 years old, goes down to Egypt. And he's afraid that Sarah, his wife, who's in her 80s, is going to be so tempting to the Pharaoh that the Pharaoh's going to want to marry her. And if the Pharaoh finds out that this hot-looking chick, Sarah, is already married, the only way the Pharaoh's going to be able to marry her is to kill her, to kill the husband. And Abraham doesn't want to die, so he passes himself off as Sarah's brother. Well, this story is told three times in the Bible. Twice of Abraham under different circumstances, and once of Isaac. Told in different campfires. They remember the story. Something happened very close to this. But they, if your little group preferred Isaac to Abraham, your group made Isaac the center of the story. If you had closer blood ties for some reason to Isaac, if you had better blood ties to Abraham, you'd remember it that way. The story's remembered, but the details shift a little bit. There's one called the Deuteronomy, the Deuteronomist. It's almost exclusively the book of Deuteronomy. It definitely comes out of the north. The other one we got to get to is the Priestly. This comes out of the south also, comes out of the temple, where the priests are, the only place in the Jewish faith where there are priests. For the whole period that our Bible covers is the temple in Jerusalem. Their only job, their main job, is to offer sacrifice of animals in the temple. And also, again, next time I hope we can cover the beautiful meaning of the animal sacrifice. Priests are people who are concerned with what they're doing. They're concerned with their sacrifice. So this particular tradition is all concerned with law and ritual, and it's dull. That's pretty much how priests go, you know. If all you're concerned about is how wide you make the incision when you're cutting the animal, they're not that bad. But if that's your biggest thing, how wide so you don't cut too much, you don't cut too narrow or too wide, you get to be pretty dull. A whole group of laws. This is a very late tradition. This is the first of these four that'll make the book of Genesis. This is the last. Therefore, with experiencing God more and more, they kept pushing God further and further up into the heavens. This tradition deals, will never allow God to touch man. God is completely... He loses any human traits that he had. As a matter of fact, they bring intermediaries in, where this one will have God talking to Abraham, Yahweh talking to Abraham. This tradition will introduce a phrase, the angel of the Lord, the angel of Yahweh talks to Abraham. And you're just wondering, sometimes one editor, I'll share with you in a moment, well, I'll say it now. One editor unites parts from all four traditions to make the one continuous story of the first five books of the Bible. And sometimes he'll just blend, and it doesn't upset him, things that blow our mind. You'll have Yahweh talking to Abraham, and then the next thing you know, the angel of the Lord is, the angel of Yahweh is, and you're wondering where the angel came from. Came from a different tradition covering the same story that the author's just pulling in, like weaving strands together, because he figures some other point that this tradition had to make was important. This does a lot more thinking about abstract things. So, the reason I'm really pointing them out, first is the thing I said. It's fascinating sometimes. I have a book that shows how scholars feel these first five books are composed. And it's just amazing. You can capture half a verse will be maybe in the Yahweh tradition, the second half in the Eloist tradition, the next two verses in the Priestly tradition, and maybe the rest of that chapter in the Yahweh tradition. And scholars have gone deeply enough into it that they pretty well agree on which tradition are being blended. So one editor had four different traditions. Three of them covering pretty much the same matter, one adding a whole book unique of its own. And he blends. And this is going to lead to things that I've said, different details in the same story. and the same story sometimes being told two or three times with slightly different details, but you know the same thing pretty much is happening. What the important part of this is, the most important, the reason I started off with this is, we have two creation accounts, absolutely different, not covering any of the same matter, and they come from two different traditions. The first is the priestly, and the second comes from the Yahweh. The first is from chapter 1:1. It's the six-day account, and it ends in the second chapter, fourth verse, first half of the verse. That's the six-day account. The second is the Adam and Eve account, and it goes from there until it's basically Yahweh. There are other details, but it basically comes out of the Yahweh account. And therefore, we've got to look at them separately. The people didn't care much about their prehistory until they had their own nation. And then when they looked at their prehistory, they did it to understand what is happening today. There's a phrase in there. The first five books of the Bible are known as the Penta, off the Greek word for five, Tuk, because they occurred on five continuous scrolls. Each book went on one long scroll in the Jewish Bible. Therefore, that they just picked the name, the first five books. And that's the one that, actually, this compilation of these traditions goes a little bit further than that and covers the first seven books, where they'll blend together the four different traditions. I would also like to add that the priestly tradition is concerned with priestly things. You get a lot more attention being paid to the temple and the thing that preceded the temple when the Jews, before they had Jerusalem, when they're still in a people on the wandering and roaming, the tent of the that the people had in the wilderness area. And a lot more attention to the Sabbath. That's important because it'll explain why we have the creation told in 6 days. What looking at the bottom of that first page of the outline, then the comments on the Pentateuch, it's a compilation. It isn't the product of one man. One man edits it, but he pulls together these four traditions that we've been talking about. He starts with the basic event that occurred from their leaving Egypt until they become God's people at Sinai. And then he looks at everything later, as I shared with you, in the light of that. Because here they become a people. They get their unity from God more than from any human descent. Then, after they have their traditions pretty well brought up to date, then they look at what happened before they got to that mountain. All the way back to Abraham, and only then do they start wondering what happened before Abraham, and that's examined to help them understand today. It's an introduction to the first five books, and it belongs there. It's also an introduction to the whole Bible, and it belongs there also. It deals with the stories, as I said, what we're looking at in these first 11 chapters, to summarize them. The two accounts of creation, plus the death of Cain, and the death of Abel at the hands of Cain. So you have the story of creation, the temptation, the fall, the Cain and Abel story, the story of Noah, the story of the Tower of Babel, and the two genealogies, including the one that tells us about the cat who lived over 1,000 years, the longest man who lived. And I hope to share with you why they do that. There's deep theology being taught. The material in these 11 chapters is not, as we know today, originally from the Hebrew people. It's from their pagan neighbors. Most of the stories in here we found are religious stories of the pagan neighbors that they have brought in, and they have what we say in a sense, if you'll pardon it, they've baptized the story. For example, there's no doubt about it. The story of the flood is a pagan story about a flood that occurs. But it's brought into the Bible. Anything that doesn't square with the God experience is dropped and changed. And it is made a story that to communicate truths about God's dealing with us. So it was sort of a fable that the Jews knew because their neighbors were all telling it and singing it, a long poem. They take it and they put it in their faith, changing the story, changing the names, changing the details to bring out something of a God experience. Now that one we have no doubt about because they found the story so very, very clearly. It's been sort of, if you'll pardon a Christian phrase, it's a pagan story baptized to communicate something about God. If you don't know this, that's exactly what's true of Christmas. That's how Christmas was set. Christmas, they weren't concerned about when Jesus was born, because that was the least important thing for years. For 300 and some years, to believe in Jesus meant you were going to be killed, so you weren't going to get together and celebrate his birthday. When Christianity becomes legal and they start becoming more interested in the youth of Jesus, then people want to celebrate the date of his birth. Christmas is set by the day when light starts conquering darkness. The shortest day of the year would be December 21st. Darkness is symbolic of evil. So by the 25th, people who don't have modern measurements, modern techniques of measuring light and darkness, pretty well know that light has turned the tide and light is now conquering darkness. The Romans had a big, great feast for a pagan god celebrating this victory. The Christians, if you can't fight them, join them. Christians couldn't end this celebration. It was too nice a time. So all they did was they brought the birth of Jesus and they put it on that date as the date it was to be celebrated. And they brought their theology just fit so beautifully, since we are told 300 years before this that Jesus is the light of the world and that he does cast out darkness, so it fits that date. So they baptize a pagan Roman feast so that Christians can continue what they've been doing, celebrating it in such a great manner. This happens in the same way then with these pagan stories that are brought into the book of Genesis. Let's now the biblical writers in no way are trying to give us a scientific account or a historical one. What really happened before Abraham? Their emphasis is on God saving, on salvation. God relating with them, and therefore they're telling us something about how this same God relates with us. It's done for its effect today, not for its yesterday history. And if you understand it this way, you might really appreciate in an entirely new way the wonder of those introductory chapters. Let's take a look at the six-day account. As I told you, this is the first account of creation. It's the one we know. There's very beautiful lines in it. In the beginning, the Spirit of God hovers over the water. There's already water before God starts creating. Water is chaotic. This is one of the things that will be important to understand in the whole Bible. Water has no order. You know, it's there. It doesn't take any solid mass. Chaos is the opposite of God. God from chaos brings order always. And that, if you want to know what God wants to do in all of his acting, that would be, from the beginning to the end of the Bible, just a brief summary of all of God's acting. From the chaos of nothing, from the chaos of water, he brings the order of the universe. That was his first creation. He does it by his... And here there is one Hebrew word, his ruah. And that word means three things: wind, spirit, and breath. It's exactly, you know, just one word for all of them. The wind of God hovers over the chaos and brings order out of it. The Spirit of God hovers over the chaos and brings order out of it. The breath of God hovers over the chaos and brings order out of it. In the new creation, Jesus is again in water at the moment of his baptism, and the Spirit comes down upon him in the form of a dove, and we're told it's the Spirit. That's a way to tell us that God's bringing a new creation, the order of a whole new level, a spiritual level where there is chaos, the chaos of sin, of emptiness, of not being able to accept yourself. The same is used exactly for Pentecost. At Pentecost, the wind, you hear a sound of mighty wind go roaring through the house. And you know that it's the Spirit of the Lord coming and settling over each people. That's a symbolic way of telling you, hey, you are being offered by the Spirit of God to participate in a new creation. But then you got to know what creation is for. Creation is intended to bring order out of chaos. And that's what God is offering you. The story of this creation is told in 6 days with God resting on the seventh. It's a very set up, very schematized thing. And on all but the second day, as I look here, one of the most important refrain is, and God saw that it was good. That was for the first day. For the third day, we're told twice, and God saw that it was good. And this every other day, we're told at least once, and on one of the others, again, we're told twice that it was good. And at the end of the sixth day, there's the line, and God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning, a sixth day. There is no intention for you to believe the order in which things are created, nor to believe the 6 days. The simplest way to prove that would be, I'll have to jump ahead of myself and compare the accounts. In the first account, God makes, if you notice this carefully, he makes the birds on the end of the fifth day. So the birds are made. The sixth day starts off and he makes the animals. And then he has a major break and he makes man. The second account really gives you to understand that God does it all in one day. There's one sentence there that we don't read correctly, but it's in the day that the Lord made the earth and the heavens. And that means everything in that account. In the day, in that particular day, the one day when God did everything. So that shows that the 6 days aren't important. Also that the order isn't important, that you don't have to go in there and say, well, we don't know how long the day was. It didn't have to be a 24-hour day. It could be a billion-year day. But this is the order in which they happened. You'll find a contradiction in the second account. In the second account, God makes man. And he's all alone. And it's no good for man to be alone. And so, God makes the birds and the animals, and he brings them to man to see if they'll be fit company. And they're not. And so he makes woman, and man's never had enough time to find out if he's alone anymore from that day on. But this is the order now. In the first two chapters, there's a clear contradiction. And the editor is not a dum-dum. He's a brilliant man when you see how he's pulled them together. He saw this. Why didn't he correct either of these things? Why didn't he say on the 6 days when God created the earth and the heavens? Why didn't he just change this order around in either place? Because they're not important. That's not what he's teaching. What he's teaching in this 6 day account is there's one God. This man experiences a God. He's the only God. He knows that from the experience. Hey, this God that's touching me inside me is so great there can't be any other. The sun and the moon and the stars and the skies, I mean, all these things that the Egyptians are worshiping and the Babylonians, they're not gods. There's one God, and he's made everything. So there's one God who made everything, and that refrain, who made everything good. Oh, it's all so good. That's the message of the first account. The great and primary lesson is God's unique position as creator of everything. Now, God is acting, therefore, to bring order out of chaos. There is a God. Now, this is important. Let's make these things applicable today. Wherever within you at this moment there is chaos, God is acting to bring order out of it. Your fears, your uncertainties, if you'll just open yourself up, God's acting to bring order out of that chaos. So often we try to establish our own order out of chaos, and our struggles really get us down. Another major concern is the Sabbath, which already was being observed. Now, you got to remember that this account comes clearly out of the priestly school. It's put in 6 days to help memory, because there's no writing, with God resting on the seventh. Now, this is written, this account is probably written.